To the rich man's bright lodges I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 513 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. This week's show, we're looking again at war, and specifically the ideas which are necessary to motivate people to take part in it. For the second hour, I've adapted a film by Emilio Palcool called Operation Hollywood, about the 90 years or so of close collaboration between the US military establishment and the US movie-making establishment. Before that, we have a half hour from a series called History Counts. Their episode, Propaganda 101, looks at the techniques used to create a demand for war and to manufacture consent to policies for which there was no consent. We're going to start the show with an adaptation of Gwyn Dyer's film, which takes us inside an army training camp in the US, called Anybody's Son Will Do.
These young men are in the Soviet Army and proud of it. They're mounting guard on Lenin's tomb. Yet if their grandparents had emigrated to America, they might be in the U.S. Army now, and they'd be equally proud of that. Like most Soviet soldiers, like most soldiers anywhere, they've never been in a real war. But there are, on average, about 20 wars going on in the world at any given time, and they are all waged by men who learn to be soldiers away from the battlefield. All soldiers belong to the same profession, and it makes them different from everybody else. They have to be different, for their job is ultimately about killing and dying, and that doesn't come naturally to any human being. Yet all soldiers are born civilians. The method for turning young men into soldiers, people who kill other people, is basic training. It's essentially the same all over the world, and it always has been, because young men everywhere are pretty much alike. It doesn't really matter where you're coming from or what you've been doing before. Where the kids on this bus are coming from is all over the United States, and they're as motley a group of 18-year-olds as you're likely to find. But what they're about to go through will turn them into the same thing. Soldiers. They'll be in the United States Marine Corps, not the Soviet Army, but beneath the uniforms, there's very little difference. It's now 2 o'clock in the morning, and this bus is not late. Marine recruits always arrive at Parris Island training base in the middle of the night, and they won't set foot outside the base again for 3 months. The secret of basic training is that it's not really about teaching people things at all. It's about changing people so that they can do things they wouldn't have dreamt of otherwise. If you want to change people quickly and radically, what you do is put them in a place where the only right way to think and to behave is the way you want them to. You isolate them. And then you apply enormous physical and mental pressure.
You'll be here at recruit sleeping bags for 2 5 days. During this time period, you're going to receive all of your uniforms, all of your shots, your service record book will be brought up to date. Everything you need to be processed in the Marine Corps. Who does not understand that? Now, where are my group leaders? Group leaders. Get up here on the sidewalk facing that way, right there on the curb, Mo. Hurry up, Travis, I don't have all day. I said get on the curb facing the group.
Facing me. Do not run. Walk quickly. run. Walk swiftly. Go ahead now, straight to the front. Hurry up, walk quickly.
Go, quickly, sit down in that chair. Give me another private in here.
Move out there.
Stand right in front of that chair over there. Give me another private in here. Stand right in front of that chair. Get in here, you. Stand in front of that chair. We move quickly, private. We've already been told that a dozen times.
The first step in basic training anywhere is always the same. It happened to me when I joined the Navy 20 years ago. The recruit is stripped of all evidence of his civilian identity, his hair, his clothes, everything that makes him look and feel like an individual. Marine basic training is more extreme than in most armies, but essentially what's happening to these teenagers here is happening to other 18-year-olds all over the world at the same time. They're entering a machine which turns out a very special and artificial product, soldiers. And we're going to follow them through the machine.
Parris Island prides itself in being one of the finest training facilities, organizations in the entire world. The United States Marine Corps has 205 years of illustrious history to speak for itself. You're trying to be a member of that organization. You have made the most important decision you have in your life up to this period in time by signing your name, your life, your pledge to the government of the United States of America. Even more importantly, the United States Marine Corps, a brotherhood, an elite unit. In 10.3 weeks, you are going to become a member of that history, those traditions, this organization, if you have what it takes. All of you want to do that by virtue of you signing your name as a man. The Marine Corps says, and we say in the Marine Corps, that we build men. Well, I'll go a little bit further. We develop the tools that you have, and everybody has those tools to a certain extent right now. We're going to give you the blueprints, and we are going to show you how to build a Marine. You've got to build a Marine, do you understand?
Yes, sir! Get up!
Hurry up! Hurry up!
Get on line now!
Get on now!
Out! Out!
Ready!
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
They've been given their uniforms and their shots, and their first day of real training is beginning. It's 5 o'clock in the morning.
36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52
dedicated rompin', stompin', bloodthirsty, kill-crazy United States Marine Corps recruits, sir. And they'll chant it every morning for the next 70 days.
Sir, hurry up!
Just leave it alone for now and get dressed. Get off your knees.
Get off your knees, McKenna!
There are times when the recruits must think they've blundered into some nightmare version of summer camp. But everything has a purpose here. Summer camp is not preparing you for combat.
We assaulted a fortified position with concrete bunkers emplaced with machine guns, automatic weapons, and we took it. It would take...
Many of the men who train recruits at Paris Island are Vietnam veterans. They understand exactly what's being done to the recruits and why.
And we killed about, I'd estimate, probably 35 North Vietnamese soldiers in the assault. And we only lost three killed. I think it's two or three and about 8 or 10 wounded. But, you know, what they teach you really it doesn't faze you until it comes down to the time to use it. But it's in the back of your head, you know. Like, what do you do when you come to a stop sign? It's in the back of your head, and it's there, and you react automatically.
I can motivate a recruit, and in third phase, if I tell him to jump off the third deck, he'll jump off the third deck. And that's just, you know, like I said before, it's a captive audience. And I can train that guy I can do anything I want to do, want him to do. Because I guess you could say in a way we brainwash him a little bit. But, you know, they're good people. They're good kids, and they ought to do the right thing. We got some bad kids, but, you know, we weed those out. As far as he's talking about motivation, here we can motivate them to do anything they want in recruit training.
Is on edge. Shoulder width apart. Now lean back. Lean back. Lean back. Lean back. I got the rope. You ain't going nowhere. Just reach down about 3 inches on the right hand. Get some more rope so we can get you started here. There you go. Now lean back. You ain't going nowhere. Now start off with your left foot. Walk. Walk straight. Don't start swaying again. Walk straight. Let it slide through your daggone right hand there.
All right, stop. Now I want you to bound out a few times. Just push off. Push off. Keep your feet shoulder width apart.
You don't know how to pay attention, do you? No, you don't. No, you don't.
Put your feet in front of you. You got to give yourself some slack. You understand that?
Belay him down.
Many of these young men have never done anything difficult and dangerous before. Almost everybody is afraid the first time he goes off this tower. Yet things are not quite as they seem here. The real lesson being taught is that if you can overcome your fear, you will be perfectly safe. And here, during training, it's true.
Hey, drill instructor.
Sir.
Drill instructor, send him back up here to me. All the way back up. You don't wait in line, son. You come see me.
What was it like for you the first time you found yourself in combat?
Well, I'd say just like the rest of them, you know, I was scared to death. You know, I went over, I just had turned 18. Just had turned 18. Came into Da Nang, they sent me up to Dong Ha, and I was just scared. I was a scared individual. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what was going to, you know. How can I say it? I don't know.
How long did it take you before you got used to being in combat?
I didn't. I have to say that.
You
didn't
get used to it. You just develop reflexes to it. You never get used to it. I don't think anybody can ever say they're used to it. If they are, they're a little bit.
The longer you stay, the more. Well, I say the better your reflexes get. You can act in different situations a lot quicker. The more you can accept it, but getting used to it, you never can. There's just no way, you know. Living, I was in the infantry and a grunt, and I tell you, just living from day to day is a big accomplishment.
Next two move up to the post. Go as fast as you can. You go as fast as you can without stopping. The longer you spend on that cable, the more chance you are of hitting that water. You understand that?
Yes, sir. Get up there, Fade. Get up there, Fade.
Go, Fowler.
Change over, Fowler. Well, Fowler, get back up there. Fowler, get up there. Hurry up. Hurry up. Everybody's waiting on you. Hurry up. Get up there. Get up there. Look behind you. You got a whole line behind you. Get up there. Real quick. Come here. Well, get out of the water. Don't contaminate your own thing.
Real good.
Come here.
You quit because you don't have any guts.
No, sir.
What are you quit for? Well, why didn't you get back up there then?
I tried you, sir.
Oh, yeah, I saw you try. I saw it. Go back. Go back and change clothes. You're useless to your unit now.
The hurdles of basic training are set low enough that most people can get over them. And all those who've made it across yet another obstacle are stronger by Fowler's defeat. Day by day, the group is feeling more special, more confident, more like real men.
I had just dropped out of high school. I wasn't doing much on the street, except hanging out, as most teenagers would be doing. So they gave me an opportunity, a recruiter picked me up, gave me a good line and said that, you know, I could make it in the Marines, that I have a future ahead of me. And since I was living with my parents, I figured that I could start my own life here and grow up a little.
I had a little two-bit job as a maid, and I was, one day I just said to myself, you know, you're a maid, what are you doing here? You gotta get your act together.
You're running out of time, Fraley. Galloway. What are you doing? You only did one thing wrong there. It's inside out.
Knapsack. Ha! Knapsack, I'll knapsack you. How about fixing your little hat there, August, huh?
Yes, sir.
Fix your hats now!
Yes, sir!
Keep playing around. Get all the thrash out of there and stick your little field jack inside your pack.
Every Marine will tell you that your DI, your drill instructor, is the one face you will never forget, ever. For 11 weeks, the DI is the god who rules a recruit's universe, and he is never satisfied. The DIs may sometimes seem to behave like sadistic lunatics, but in fact they're the cream of the Marine Corps. All the yelling and harassment has a purpose. It creates a structured environment with high but precisely calculated levels of stress, which after 8 weeks is already transforming these teenaged former civilians into soldiers.
No.
Yet!
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 It's not a Y sound anymore. It's going to be yet! Yet! You understand?
Sure.
U-A-T.
Yet!
Yet! Say it.
Yet!
Seat!
Yeah.
Oh! Just! Right hand, right knee, left hand, left knee, sit up straight.
When I was going to school, we used to have to recite the Pledge of Allegiance every day. But they don't do that now. You know, we've got kids that come in here now. When they first get here, they don't know the Pledge of Allegiance or the flag. And that's something that's like a cardinal sin, I think. You know, if they don't teach that stuff in grade school, you know, my daughter will know that by the time she's three. She's two now and she's working on it. But I think that you have to know that basic stuff. I'm kind of disappointed they don't do that. Little things like that.
Saying prayers in school. What's wrong with saying a prayer? Mm-hmm. I mean, these civilizations getting out of hand here or something, you know, all these laws and everything. Everybody's dreaming up a new law to conform to the times, but a lot of that's garbage, I feel. You know, you've got to have your basics, you know, the groundwork where you can start to build a child's brain from. And you just can't build it from these garbage laws that they don't even understand, you know, civil rights, this, that, and the other. And the laws, you know, no prayers in school because it's violating his civil rights, and no Pledge of Allegiance because he might be a communist or whatever, you know. That's not right.
Hello, Brody. Hello, Brody.
Marching like this, with every man moving his body in the same way at the same moment, is a direct physical way of learning two things a soldier must believe: that orders have to be obeyed automatically and instantly, and that you're no longer an individual, but part of the group.
Hello, Brody.
It's 100 years since mass formations like this were any use on the battlefield, but every army in the world still drills its troops, especially during recruit training. There's some kind of inspection every day in recruit training, and it has a purpose beyond the nitpicking attention to detail. It's a ritual confirming the recruit's progress. But there are always details to criticize in the closed world of Paris Island.
You in slow motion today?
No, sir.
And how fast are you supposed to do the manual of arms?
Probably told to do slowly, sir, and distinctly, sir. It's
supposed to be 120 counts per minute, is it not?
Yes, sir.
You got a piece of hair in your ear.
Yes, sir.
From the haircut. You didn't have a shower last night, did you?
Yes, sir.
You didn't clean your ears very good then, did you?
Yes, sir.
You shaved this morning?
Yes, sir.
Little hairs are fast growing, ain't they?
Yes, sir.
You also got hair on either side of your nose right there. Are you going to start flying today?
No, sir.
Well, how about locking your elbows into your side like you're supposed to be? Like you was taught and forming. When I touch, you remove. The little garbage in your bore. Was it punched out before you came out here?
Yes, sir.
Who punched out? You or one of your drone sluggers?
Private, sir.
You sure?
Yes, sir.
You're not crying, are you?
No, sir.
Cold air getting the eyeballs?
Yes, sir.
Your elbows are flapping again. You must be going flying. Forgot to pull the trigger here, sweetheart. How many types of wounds are there?
Sir.
What are you moving for?
Sir, there are two types of wounds, sir.
Two types of wounds.
Yes, sir.
Good ones and bad ones, right?
No, sir.
Name them. Name me the two types
sir,
of wounds.
There are five types of wounds, sir.
Name them.
Sir, there's the laceration wound, the puncture wound, the incision wound, the abrasion wound, and the crush wound, sir.
Which is the most dangerous?
Sir, the most dangerous is the crush wound, sir.
Why?
Sir, because there's massive cell damage done, sir.
An internal damage, right?
Yes, sir.
One, three, five, two, one, three. And if trying to get that empty right.
Over on the other side of the base, strictly segregated from the male recruits, they're training women Marines.
One, two, three, four! One, two, three, four! United States Marine Corps!
They're not currently expected to go into combat, but some of them have got combat training.
Now squeeze, keeping the tips centered in your rear sight. Squeezing, darn the tip.
Seven bullseye on the slow rapid fire, and six bullseyes on the fast rapid fire.
And you never shot a rifle before?
I did all the TV games. You plug them in the TV and you know, on the TV. This is the first time.
Was it fun?
After I got over being scared to death, it was fun. When the instructor kept on telling me how good I was doing, it was a lot of fun.
What part of it was scary for you?
The fact that it could kill you. If you're on the other end of it. I don't like the idea of killing anything.
Few male officers who train women doubt that they would function effectively in combat. Women lack a lot of the traditional male notions that make men recruits easy to mold into soldiers, but the training would still do its job.
I see how easy it is. You can come out here and qualify just like a male recruit. It's all in your head.
I mean, I may not at this moment go into combat, but knowing that I can fire as well as I can fire now, knowing that today, I'd go in. I believe in my country. I believe in the idea of the president. I'd fight to keep it. So.
What bothers the officers is how the presence of the women would affect the men. The basic combat unit, a small group of men bound together by strong male ties of loyalty and solidarity, is a time-tested system that works. If you let women in, then who are the men protecting, and who can they feel superior to?
I'll try to have little Susie's back home. Yeah. You see the big old smiles come on the faces then. Mention little Susie. How many privates, if you don't have a little Susie now, how many are going to find one when they get home? You bet. You're going to find the first cheap slut you can get back home. What do you mean, no? You're a Marine, you're going to do it. We go home with little Susie. We're in nice companionship with little Susie. And then here you are getting hot and heavy. And then you're getting ready to go down there and make that dive, Private. Susie says.
Susie is Marine Corps slang for women. It's short for Susie Rottencrotch.
If you don't want to get back home and indulge in this little adventure. You can show your girlfriend the hand and arm signal for close it up,
Private.
And you want her to close up those nasty little thighs of hers, do you not, Private? All right, press the hand and arm signal. The arms are lateral to your shoulder height, the fingers are extended and joint, thumb along the forefinger, and the palms are facing toward the front. This is the starting position for close it up. And all you're going to do, Price, is bring the arms forward, just like you're closing it up, right, Private? Just like that. Everyone got that?
Yes, sir!
But, Private, in addition, I want you to dedicate all this training to one very special person. Can anyone tell me who that is, Private? No, not your senior drill instructor. You're going to dedicate all this training, Private, to your enemy. To your enemy. The reason being, so he can die for his country, right, Private?
Yes, sir!
You bet. So who are we going to dedicate all this training to, Private?
Yes, sir! Yes, sir!
For American troops at this point in history, these Soviet soldiers are the main enemy, and vice versa. But it doesn't really matter who the enemy is. It's the idea of the enemy that's important. That's the outside threat that binds a combat unit together so strongly that its members will make the most extraordinary sacrifices for each other.
A Marine is laying out in the middle of the paddock, and he's wounded. He's not crying for mom. He's wounded. He might be moaning a little bit. He might be cussing, because he's mad. Another Marine that's in safety because he got behind a dike. He's real safe. But he crawls out into that paddy and he pulls that wounded Marine to safety, risking his own life. When probably the Marine's gonna bite the bullet, he's gonna die. And probably the one that goes out and tries to save him is gonna die. Why is that done? You ask yourself that question. And you don't check out the Marine's name, you don't check out where he came from, you don't check out how tall he is or how short he is. You don't care whether you're from California and he's from New York. All you care about is he's a Marine. And he's in your unit. He's one of you.
Lift your heads and hold them high.
Lift your heads and hold them high.
33-13 is a passing by.
33-13 is a passing by.
Singing left, right,
I lay you.
Elevation.
Elevation.
Dedication.
Armies everywhere try to catch their recruits young because they're more vulnerable and easily influenced then. And they don't really understand about dying. You can train older men to be soldiers. It's done in every major war. But you can never get them to believe that they like it.
We're having a ball.
We're having a ball.
All the way.
All the way.
We love it.
We love it.
Can't leave it.
But if you're young enough, all the ideas about heroism and military glory that you picked up in childhood are still there, unadulterated by adult experience, like buttons waiting to be pressed.
We will fight on.
The enemy that you're going to have here at Paris Island is in every one of us. It's in the form of cowardice. The most rewarding experience you're going to have in recruit training is standing online every evening, and you'll be able to look into each other's eyes, and you'll be able to say to each other with your eyes, by God, we've made it one more day. We've defeated the coward. You are innocent until proven guilty. Make no mistake about that. This is not a kangaroo court. You are not already found guilty by just the mere fact of you standing in front of me. Do you understand that, recruit?
Yes, sir.
You've acknowledged understanding your rights under Article 31.
Yes, sir.
I have in front of me charges. One charge, violation of Uniform Code of Military Justice, Article 91, disobedience of a lawful order. In that, you...
Captain Pingree went to Vietnam a corporal, but promotion sometimes comes very quickly in combat. Men in command get killed, and others have to step into their jobs instantly. He came back an officer. And it's always those who survive and succeed that pass the military ethic on to the next generation.
On or about 10:30, the 6th of March, willfully disobey the same. Put it on the line. Say something to me, recruit, that will help me better decide what punishment to give you.
Private's never been in any trouble before, sir.
When are you going to get in trouble again?
Private hopes he doesn't, sir.
Hopes? The Marine Corps hasn't been founded on hope, Private. The Marine Corps has been founded on doing against unsurmountable odds. We don't hope and we don't wish. I want to know when you're going to disobey another order.
Private's not going to disobey another order, sir.
You're not?
No, sir.
Is that your word?
Yes, sir.
Well, what's going to happen to you if you do?
Private, go to jail, sir.
Go to jail. Worse than that, recruit. You'll go back to life a civilian.
Obviously, you've got some kind of a problem there, Private, or you would not have come up to me saying you want to go home and violate the contract that you signed, right?
Yes, sir.
So now what, in your own words, do you think about what we talked about?
I'd still like to go home, sir.
Private, that's not what I asked you. And we brought up certain points of interest, did we not?
Yes, sir.
We brought up the fact that you have not been able to hold a decent paying job for any period of time, correct?
Yes, sir.
Now you're telling me that you want to quit on the biggest thing of your life. You know what a bad discharge carries with it, right?
No, sir.
It carries a very high stigma. You know what stigma means?
No, sir.
It's a mark, a black mark. Nobody has taken the time to tell these young studs, Sandlot's over, son. Reality is here. It's knocking on the door. Hell no, it's beating the damn door down. And we've got about 10 more years left, and somebody's going to kick the damn thing in. And they're going to have a big red star on their little helmet.
I don't make the rules, and neither do you. But whether you like it or not, this world is not too easy. And if you expect to get anywhere, you are going to have to do it. Not me. Not me.
These privates we're getting here, the 17 to 25-year-old, the age that they grew up in, the late 60s and the 70s, the age of Aquarius, peace, love, etc. This is beautiful. But they're living in a dream world.
You're making a big mistake, son. A very big mistake. And you know that because I told you for the fifth time, don't you?
Yes, sir.
You know that, don't you?
Yes, sir.
Now, you going to go train?
No, sir.
Why? Because you're not a man, right?
Yes, sir.
You're a little boy, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
You can't be trusted, right?
Yes, sir.
That's what I thought. Now, you take any individual, no matter what he is, civilian, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, if he's seen combat, he's different. When I first came back in 69, my mother would not go in the same bedroom with me when I was asleep. I was dangerous. The first night I was back, they had a two-bedroom trailer. I slept in the floor because my sister was home at the time. My mother came by, and she was going to step over my arm, which was flung out the side, and go turn the air conditioner off. She got within 2 feet of me, and I wasn't even awake. I had her down. I had her by the throat, and my father pulled me off of her, and I was not even awake. I just reacted. There was a footstep, I didn't know where it was, and so I reacted. I was dangerous. And it, you know, as time passes, it gets over. But you never really forget. You never really forget. It's sometimes, especially when I'm tired. Say I worked a 24-hour shift, and I go home, I'm really tired. Sometimes when I first lay down, they'll pass scenes, come through my mind. Things that I have seen, things that I have done. It makes me different, and it makes me all the more apprehensive because these individuals that we're getting now, they haven't even seen a God-blessed car wreck, much less somebody with the whole side of his head blowed off Freedom has a price, and I believe this, and I preach it. Freedom has one price, and history bears me out. There's one price that freedom will accept, and that's blood.
You have got to be very aggressive. Once you have got your opponent on the run, once you've got him on the run, that means you go ahead and strike with that first killing blow. Private, that fight might not stop. Just because you made contact, that don't mean you stop. You don't cut him no slack. Don't give him room to breathe. Stay on top of him. He's going to be backpedaling all the way with his guards up. And you stay on top of him. Keep pumping that stick. Anybody follow me there?
Yes, sir!
That means that there should be nothing out here today. But a lot of groaning, moaning, a lot of snot eyeballs falling. And that's just enough of a lot of heads rolling all over the place. I don't want to see no holding and no pity pat.
There's aggression in all of us, men, women, children, babies. Armies don't have to create it, and they can't even increase it. But most of us learn to put limits on our aggression, especially physical aggression, as we grow up.
Swing it, swing it, swing it, hit him, hit
him. It's about time.
A crucial part of turning people into soldiers is teaching them to ignore these limits, so that in the right circumstances, against the enemy, they'll go all the way and kill.
Hold your stick!
Get in there,
Adam.
In some ways, what basic training produces is the uniformed equivalent of a modern street gang, a bunch of tough, confident kids full of bloodthirsty talk. But kid gangs don't actually kill each other in large numbers. If they behaved the way armies do, you'd need trucks to clear the bodies off the streets every morning. But they're held back by the civilian belief, the normal human belief, that killing another person is an awesome act with huge consequences. So basic training has one more vital job to do, to indoctrinate recruits with the idea that the enemy, whoever he may be, is not fully human, and so it's all right to kill him.
Now, first off, what is a mine? A mine is nothing more, Province, than an explosive or chemical substance that is designed or made to destroy and kill the enemy. You want to rip out his eyeballs again, you want to tear apart his love machine, you want to destroy him, Province. You don't want to have nothing left of him. You want to send him home in a glad bag to his mommy. Marines are born trained killers. You gotta prove that every day. You understand?
Yes, sir!
Alright. Okay. Now, what are some of the uses for grenades and pyrotechnics? Well, I just mentioned the first one. Produce casualties. Far too many Iranians in the world, are they not?
Yes, sir!
Go over there and flatten that country, should we not?
Yes, sir!
I'll take this series right now. We'll go over there and kick some ass. All right.
The idea of me killing a person when I came down here just, you know, is unheard of. You know, you didn't do that. It was, you know, like squirrel hunting without a license, you know, and you know, you didn't do things like that. But once you came here and they motivated you and just kept you every day constantly thinking about that, and by the time you leave here, then it's something you still don't want to do, but you've got it in your mind that you want to do it so bad that you actually go out and do it when you have to. And it seemed like it was a lot easier, you know, because of the motivation here.
That's good. There goes another one, 15 meters apart.
This is the way most people do get killed in combat, suddenly and at random. Basic training cannot prepare anybody for this, but it does create a false confidence strong enough to deliver men to the battlefield.
Move!
The Vietnam era was, of course, then was at its peak, you know, and everybody was motivated more or less toward the, you know, the kill thing, you know. We'd run PT in the morning, and every time your left foot hit the hit the deck, you had to chant kill, 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 kill. It was drilled in your mind so much that it seemed like when it actually came down to it, that it didn't bother you. You know, of course, the first one always does, and it seems to get easier. Not easier, because it still bothers you with every one, you know, that you actually kill and you know you kill.
You develop that's a sense of brutality in a combat that you don't normally have stateside, because you live under two completely different sets of morals. You couldn't you couldn't survive in a combat situation with the same set of morals you have in everyday life. You'd never make it through the first week.
You know, if seeing your best friend's head blown off don't motivate you, then there's something wrong with you. You know, you've got to do something, because the next day it might be you. People say, well, I can never kill a man. That's foolish. They can. They, you know, anybody can kill. I try to motivate these people to such a point that once they went into combat, I tell them what to expect. You know, the motivation it takes to actually look down the sights of your rifle and pull the trigger and kill a guy, that's the motivation it takes. That's what you get paid to do. It's like being a bag boy at a supermarket, you know. If that's what you get paid to do is bag groceries, you bag groceries. If you get paid to look down your sights and pull a trigger and kill a man, that's what you do. I didn't feel that way when I first went to Vietnam, but after watching a couple of friends of mine get blown up really bad, you know, I lost that opinion. I said, hell, I'm getting paid for a day's work, I'm going to give them a day's work.
That muzzle looks great. It looks super. That muzzle really looks great. How about you better hope you get through there quick and able to unclog that muzzle before the enemy gets a hold of you. Stop. Now what are you going to do? Right now you got an enemy bunker right over here that you're supposed to assault. Your fire team leader tells you to get up and assault the bunker. What are you going to do? You know what you're going to do? You're going to turn around. And you'll probably get shot in the back because you can't do anything with that weapon.
The whole idea about the low and the high crawl is to keep your muzzle out of the dirt. Now, can you see light down there?
Barely, sir.
Barely. The whole idea of the low crawl and the high crawl is to keep that muzzle out so it can fire.
Yes, sir.
Not just protect you to accomplish the mission.
All right, sir.
Carry on.
Sir. Help!
Help! Basic training has been much the same in every army in every age, because it's always working with the same raw material that's already there in teenage boys. A fair amount of aggression, a strong tendency to hang around in groups, an absolutely desperate desire to fit in. Basic training is one of life's few total experiences, a mild form of brainwashing, if you like, and it works. You may be slightly insane at the end of it, I know I was, but that wears off after a while. What's left behind is a sense of loyalty to the service and a set of instinctive reactions that operate automatically, even in combat.
I don't want to repeat that experience.
You'd be a fool if you did. No,
I don't think anybody want to go back out and do that.
I don't. I got a cousin with one leg. I had some buddies that, you know, lost their lives, and I don't want to repeat that experience.
We're all sitting here, three people in the Marine Corps, prepared by virtue of our stripes sitting here, and the fact that we're in the military, we're ready to go out and do it again.
The part we hold, and we got buddies that ain't.
It's like insurance. We're hoping it doesn't happen, but we're ready to do it.
But you know, the biggest thing about it is, I think that although we don't want to go back and do it again, if the bell rung at 7:30, we'd be in line at 8 o'clock to go.
I like the hand-to-hand combat and et cetera, things like that. It's a little rough going on me, and since I have a small frame, I would like to become deadly, as I would put it. I like to have them words, especially the way they've been teaching me here.
Sometimes feel like drill instructors make you feel like you're going to like it.
Like what?
Like the war. Going out and, you know, as a killing people. They psych your mind up for it. I haven't done it. I'd go out there if I had to, though. I can't say whether I'd like it or not, because I've never killed nobody, you know.
I'd like to be the first one on the beach.
doesn't matter if you lose or not, last.
I'm not scared at all, because when I come in here, I never thought I'd jump off a 50-foot tower or throw a grenade. Drill instructors build your confidence up. Right now, I feel I can do anything.
As we view these graduates about to move to their new duty stations throughout the world, we do so with a considerable measure of pride, for we realize how much they have accomplished, but further, we know that we are part of it. Ladies and gentlemen, now that you are part of the Marine Corps family, I ask that as you return to your homes, you take with you the Parris Island story. Let it be known that good men, men like your sons, who have met the challenge of recruit training, are better for it.
So long as nations keep armed forces, there will always be enough recruits. Young men are not natural soldiers any more than they're natural carpenters or accountants, but it's a trade that almost anybody can learn. Soldiering takes up a much bigger part of your life than most jobs, but it doesn't take a special kind of person. Anybody's son will do.
I'm so proud of my son.
Have you seen a big change in him?
He's beautiful.
He's different. He looks more manly.
He's a man now.
You glad he did it?
Oh, I'm happy.
I did it for them.
I'm proud of him. I'm so proud. He's a beauty.
Real feel good inside. Glad it's all over, at least the boot camp part. They say the toughest is still to come. But
this your dad?
Yeah, this is my father. He's a retired Marine.
Thank you. How do you feel about your son now?
Oh, I think it's great. I think this is the best thing that happened to him. Really do.
Where are you going now?
I'm going to be going home for 10 days. Then I go to Memphis, Tennessee for 11 weeks of school. And then I'll get orders there for my duty station. And I'll be actually in the fleet. So it won't be long until I'm back on the road doing my job.
These young Soviet soldiers are doing their job too. And it's the same job that soldiers everywhere under all flags have to do. Even though most soldiers will never actually fight, they spend most of their time preparing for war. The whole nature of the military profession is shaped by that single goal. Not that it's soldiers who cause wars. Governments, acting on our behalf, are the cause of wars. We simply employ soldiers to do the dying for us.
Yes, Gwyn Dyer did just say governments acting on our behalf. That's the theory. Now here's another angle on it from Ken McDermott Rowe. His series History Counts, very worth checking out. It's available online at www.historycounts.org. This episode is entitled Propaganda 101.
Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Propaganda may be the most powerful weapon available to the modern state. With effective propaganda, governments can bend whole populations to their will. And the best part is that no one notices it's been used. In today's program, we're going to uncover the mysteries of the art of propaganda as we examine its modern origins and techniques. So please stay tuned to this edition of History Counts, Propaganda 101. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we're going to discuss the art of government propaganda. To help us understand it, we're very pleased to have as our special guest Mark Crispin Miller, Professor of Culture and Communications at New York University. Professor Miller is the author of numerous books, including Cruel and Unusual, Bush-Cheney's New World Order, and Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election. He wrote the introduction to the recently republished classic Propaganda by Edward Bernays and is featured in the documentary films Stealing America, Vote by Vote, about the 2004 presidential election, and Orwell Rolls in His Grave, about corporate control of media. Professor Miller, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I'd like to start with a quote from MIT Professor Noam Chomsky, and I'd like your comments on it. He wrote in Media Control, "Propaganda is to democracy what the bludgeon is to a totalitarian state." What are your thoughts on that?
There's a lot of truth in that. Propaganda is the main means whereby the state, in an ostensible democracy, has its way with the people. This has really been the case for the last 100 years or so, most notably since World War I. You've got to master public opinion in order to do what you want to do, and the way to do that is to use propaganda.
One of the most important propagandists of the last century, Joseph Goebbels, said, in propaganda, truth should be used as frequently as possible.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Joseph Goebbels was, you know, Hitler's minister of propaganda. He's the example that most often comes to mind when we talk about state propaganda at its most sinister and lurid. But he had his counterpart, he has had various counterparts in the West, even though American propaganda hasn't been as spectacular as Nazi propaganda. I think you could easily argue that the American government has relied as extensively on propaganda, especially over the last 10 years or so, as the Nazis did. Goebbels said a lot of quite brilliant things about propaganda. He noticed, for example, that the most effective propaganda is the kind that calls the least attention to itself. When you know you're being approached by a propagandist, when you know you're being addressed by someone with an ulterior motive, you're on your guard. Whereas if the propaganda seems almost as it were part of the natural environment, it's like the very air we breathe, and we don't quite notice it, we don't focus on it, it's all the more effective for that, because our guard is down. You know, now Goebbels would point to various kinds of film, public spectacle, torchlight parades, but we have, in the commercial sphere, product placement and stealth marketing and all sorts of other covert methods that, in their own way, are just as cynical and just as effective as the stuff the Nazis came up with. Goebbels was right about the use of the truth. Whenever possible, propaganda must be factually accurate.
Now, Hitler said the great masses of the people will more easily fall victims to a big lie than to a small lie. Why is that?
Well, that's a very famous theory of the big lies, based on the assumption that people will be less inclined to doubt or resist an enormous lie precisely because it's hard to believe that anyone would tell a lie that big. And I think that's a perception that's extremely pertinent to the moment we're living at now.
Now, when we talk about propaganda in America, one of the intellectuals we have to talk about is Walter Lippmann, who wrote the book Public Opinion, published in 1922.
Right.
And he coined a term, the manufacture of consent.
Right.
What was Lippmann's thesis?
He had such a dark view of public reason that he believed that it was essential for the survival of democracy that there be a kind of caste of experts who are above politics and who would have the wisdom, to be blunt about it, to keep the people fooled, to direct public opinion in beneficial ways, manufacture consent, in short. This first became quite clear with the successful enterprise of the First World War. I mean, when we talk about propaganda, as we have been doing today, we tend to go immediately to the sort of grotesque and magnetic example of Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis. But the fact is that modern propaganda, whether it's commercial or political, had its roots not in fascist Europe, but in England and America in the 19th century. Modern propaganda and advertising is simply a sphere of propaganda, were both basically Anglo-American creations, the late 19th century. The rise of this new science of propaganda, if we want to call it a science, coincided with the new interest in applied psychology for political effect. And one of the things that Lippmann understood the propagandist must do is to find the ways in which one might move people at an irrational level. Lippmann understood very, very keenly that the collective mind the mind of the mob, if you want to call it that, is not a reasoning mind. It's not logical. That people en masse tend to be irrational. Now, I think that Lippmann takes this further than necessary. I think that his distrust of democracy is ultimately quite dangerous. But he makes a very compelling case in public opinion. Let's return to the example of the First World War.
Right.
Here we had a conflict of unprecedented violence that had to be sold to populations that had no particular reason to want to go to war at all. The Americans and the British were really disinclined to get involved in another war. How does one basically sell a conflict like this to people when the interests being served, in fact, are not the interests of the public? You know, it was basically an obscure imperialist rivalry.
So that's when the Creel Commission comes in.
That's right. When we're talking about the United States.
Yes.
Woodrow Wilson appointed George Creel to be the head of the Committee on Public Information, which basically had the job of selling the war to the average American. And the obverse of this, of course, the necessary obverse of all propaganda is censorship. So the committee's job was twofold. It was, first of all, to sanitize the war and make sure that its true horror didn't register at home, and also to come up with a number of very stirring, purely emotional stimuli that would get people on board. What they did was they represented the Germans as Huns. They sort of rehabilitated this old Asiatic threat and very cleverly identified the Germans with the Huns of yesteryear and represented the whole conflict as a battle between barbarism and civilization. The British were the most prolific in coming up with atrocity stories that actually bore no relation to reality whatsoever. The Prussians were indeed quite brutal, but they didn't do any of the things they were accused of doing. They didn't crucify Allied soldiers. They didn't cut the breasts off of nurses and bat them back and forth with their butts of their rifles. They didn't impale babies on bayonets. The particular commission that came up with these stories had on it a number of very famous fiction writers and poets, people like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I mean, this is the guy, you know, his Sherlock Holmes stories are beloved the world over. This guy really knows how to tell a story. People like him and like H.G. Wells and others were working for the government in a kind of literary capacity to invent these atrocity tales that would make the war almost irresistible.
Did they know the material for the stories weren't true?
I think at the very highest levels they had to know.
Do you think that the writers know, or were they just fed
It's very hard. That's the most interesting question about propaganda across the board, is the extent to which those who engage in it are themselves convinced of it. The fact is that 10 years after the war's conclusion, a very important book came out called Lies in Wartime. It was written by Lord Ponsonby, who was a socialist member of parliament. It was a short but very effective, very meticulous analysis of all the most notorious atrocity tales that had been used throughout the propaganda drive to get people on board. Ponsonby demonstrates in every case that the story was false, was made up. And this is something a lot of people had suspected, but Ponsonby let enough time go by that people were ready to hear the truth, and the book was an enormous bestseller both here and in Britain, and it did a tremendous amount to enlighten, some might say disillusion people, about what the truth really was. The reaction, after it became clear that the governments of Britain and the U.S. had really basically fooled people on a grand scale, the reaction was quite devastating. It was an enormous wave of anger and sort of cynicism. The lesson here is that, and then this is where Goebbels' point about using the truth comes into play, you have to be very careful as a propagandist not to lie so egregiously that the lies can then be exposed. Because once the lies are exposed, once people lose faith in a particular set of authorities, once the people see through a particular regime and that regime loses what we call its credibility, it's finished. There is no way to get it back.
This is a point I'd like to underline, particularly in the context of the September the 11th false flag attacks, which for many people have fatally undermined the credibility of the establishment.